This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.
Many times cultures, there's just a clash of cultures that makes it difficult. So we want to look at this. I want to say right up front, I'm not an expert on this issue, but it is a topic that I care very deeply about, and I think all of us should. All of us should care about the fact that others should be able to come into our communities and somehow integrate if we're going to actually be light in dark places. One of the questions that's probably in all of our minds is this. Is it our problem or is it their problem? Is it just a bad culture we're living in? Is it just a hard place to reach out, or is it something we're doing? And I suspect that if we took a poll here today, and if it was a little smaller group, I probably would have done that. There's probably a diversity right here of thought on that. Today I want to look at four areas. We're going to just walk through some areas and think about this question together. First of all, I want to back up and look at how we are reaching out. Are we using effective methods as we attempt to reach out? Are there cultural obstacles? Are we putting something in front of people that keeps them from coming in? And so to answer this, instead of just guessing at this, I went out and tried to interview as many people as I could that have come from non-Anabaptist background and ask questions of them. I want to look at some of their answers. Listen to what they say. We want to think about authentic church communities. What is the place, the role of the church in reaching out? Is it possible that in the middle of all of our outreach attempts, we're neglecting something of vital importance? And then finally, I want to look at some lessons from churches who are engaging seekers. Now, I want to say right up front, I'll probably mention it again, I'm not this morning holding up any one denomination, any one congregation. I think all of us have a lot to learn on this whole topic. This is simply a time for us to think about this issue. We need to acknowledge it's not an easy culture to reach out to. With media, with technology, with wealth, all that makes it very difficult. It's a distracted culture. That makes it more difficult. But the fact is, we can only actually impact ourselves and how we reach out. So let's look at that a little bit. I want to share some observations. First of all, let's think about our approach. You know, 8 years ago, I moved into Caldwell, Idaho, and we had a vision of trying to find a location in America where there was a high population of people and no Anabaptists in the area. And so we plopped down in a little town called Caldwell, just out of Boise. And I moved just across the street from a man named Joe and Mary. Joe is a hardworking Hispanic. We get along great. We have a good relationship. We talk different times. He lives just across the street. Christmas time came around the first year, and I took Joe some pastries. My wife fixes pastries for the neighbors, and we wanted to get to know them, and so I took some pastries over to Joe's, and I don't think anyone had ever knocked on Joe's door and given him something like this, and he wasn't quite sure how to respond, and so a few days later, here he came with some tamales. So it's been this way every year. Every year, I take some pastries over, and Joe brings tamales, and we really have a good relationship. In fact, a couple years ago, I had taken him some pastries, and he'd forgotten the tamales. And some carolers from our congregation came and sang to Joe, and it tripped his memory, and he ran out the back door while they were still singing at the front door to bring me some tamales, because Joe likes to keep everything even in our relationship. You know, I know a lot about Joe. Joe was a Catholic. He grew up in the Catholic Church at 19 years of age. He got burnt somehow by the Catholic Church. He saw hypocrisy there, and he walked away from church, and he's never looked back again. Joe's done with religion. As I think about all the things I know about Joe, it occurred to me that he knows a lot about me too. In fact, every time he mows his lawn, he sees this sign right up there in front of him. So he knows about me, but I wonder, what would it take to actually move Joe? Do you suppose that if I had a larger sign, that would take care of it? Or maybe if I wore a t-shirt like this and walked around his house, or maybe I just took him tracks. If I just gave Joe tracks for a while, and maybe that would move Joe. What's it going to take for Joe to take another look at Christianity? Do you think that would actually impact him? Now, I want to say this as we begin. God has to do the drawing. Jesus was very clear. He said this, "No one can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him. The Spirit must call a man, but we're called to be co-workers together with him." So what are we supposed to be doing? What's that mean? How do we be co-workers with the Joes in our lives? I want to stop just for a minute and ask you a question. What would it take right now to move your worldview? I think everyone in here probably believes in creation. But if I wanted to move you from a confident creationist to a confident evolutionist, what would that take? Do you suppose that if I stood out back here and as you went out the door, I gave each of you a tract that said evolution is the answer? Do you think that that would change your worldview? Do you think you would read that and say, oh, okay, evolution is the answer? I don't think so. I don't think any of you would be moved by a little three-page tract on evolution. It would take more than that. Why does anyone change? What does it take to shake someone's deep-rooted worldview? Well, if I wanted to move you across this line, if I was determined to teach you that evolution was correct, I would have to do something like this. I would have to expose you to something that maybe you've never thought of, some new ideas maybe, some new links in the evolutionary chain, or maybe some fresh doubts about the Bible, or something that would shake that deep-seated root of worldview that you have. It would probably take multiple exposures, not just one time, but repeated exposure to that. But let's just assume that happened. The next thing it would take is, it would take some time for you to investigate, is this evidence really valid? Is that actually valid? It would take multiple facts and time to investigate. You'd want to think about it from different angles, but assuming the logic held true, you would move on across this line to doubt, and you would finally say, you know, it's possible I might be wrong. That is a possibility. Now, you haven't moved clear over yet, but you're caught between two opposing views. You're going to have to think about this. Maybe my worldview isn't built on complete data. Maybe I don't have all the facts here. And then nothing changes. Everything holds true. You would keep moving across this line to, you know, evolution might be true. There'd be an awakening there, a possibility. And again, you'd start to shift your gaze over toward another worldview, and finally you would arrive at a place where you'd say with confidence the world evolved. There's two lessons I want us to get from this. First of all, everyone you meet already has a worldview. And they probably have it from a lot of facts they've gathered over time. And the second is, humans don't immediately change worldviews. We don't just automatically move quickly. Now, there are exemptions to this. All of us can think of examples. I had a Muslim in my home here not very long ago. He was a Christian now, but he had visions, and it moved him very rapidly along this line. But for most of us, this is a slow process. Let's go back to my neighbor Joe for just a little bit. What's it going to take for Joe to move? Now, I want us to picture this line here, moving from a confident unbeliever to a confident believer. I want you to picture also a spiritual battle going on along this line. The Holy Spirit is moving one direction, pulling him, but Satan's pushing another direction. There's battle here going on, and prayer is essential in this process. But what is going to cause Joe to reconsider? You know, Joe's going to need something that shakes his worldview. He's going to have to see something he hasn't seen before. It'll probably take some new evidence, something to make him question. Again, for many, this process is slow. Over here to doubt, maybe it is possible. You know, do I have all the facts here? Could I be wrong? Sometimes a crisis in life, a divorce, some kind of a death in the family can shake this and move people along quicker. But finally, there'd be an awakening. Maybe Jesus really was who he said he was. And the Word of God begins to work on the heart. Hope begins to emerge. And finally, you arrive over here in confidence that, yes, Jesus Christ is Lord. There's a realization, a repentance from sin, and a desire to follow Jesus. Now, I want you to think about this as you move people along this line. When you reach out to your neighbor, you reach out to those around us. Sometimes we talk about bringing God to people. You aren't bringing God to anyone. God was already there before you arrived. We're simply working together with him. God is already calling men. But increasingly in our world, people are over in this area. Now, 50 years ago, it was different. But we're living in a culture today where people are over in the, there's no foundational fear of God. We see this a little in the book of Acts. In Acts 2, We see Peter talking to people who had a foundational fear of God and the Jewish religion, and his message to them was repent and be baptized. They were right over in this section right here. They already had a foundational view of God. They were already on their way. But in Acts 17, we see a different picture. We see Paul reaching out. He didn't start with repent and be baptized. It was a heathen culture at Athens. It was more like current-day America. It was back over here. Paul started way back in the beginning. The unknown God, he made the heavens. He even used a quote from their own heathen prophets. He couldn't start at the same place as he could with the Jews. Now, sometimes we go back to Acts, and I want to say this. We're living in a time that's even more complicated than what I just described, because Acts describes how to reach out to people who have never heard the gospel. We're living in a culture where many people think they understand the gospel. Sometimes I call it contaminated soil. It's a place where people have a picture that's improper. It doesn't tell the truth about what Christianity is, especially kingdom Christianity. Let's go back a little and look at this pathway to faith. What does it take to shake an ungodly worldview? You know, we want to reach people with the gospel, and so many times we use techniques, though, that are very ineffective. So we do things like this. We pass out tracts, gospel tracts, talks about the judgment of God, redemption, about Jesus. But it's a little like me giving you a track on evolution. It doesn't connect with them because they're not even there. They're not within the scope of what that track is saying. If you don't believe in a God, why would you fear judgment? We deal with this sometimes in third world countries. If there's no fear of God, why would you worry about judgment? You've got to start back further than that. So what will reach this man? I want to suggest that it's something that I call disquieting exposure. It's something that shakes that worldview. Once he begins moving then, in this case it could be apologetics, but it's unsettling evidence, something that they haven't thought about before. As they begin to move then, they can move over to where actually gospel tracts on judgment, redemption, on Jesus, all this can actually impact them. Now this person's open to new thoughts, literature that can move him. I want to say this, the Bible provides disquieting exposure all across this continuum. The problem is people today are not reading the Bible. Today they're drawing their conclusions about Christianity from sometimes the news. They see things like this. They see God, Christians as hateful, promoters of gun rights, a political movement. It may be hard to convince them that God is love. It's very important to consider the message we carry. Think about even your accountants, the way you carry the message. Are they seeing joy and love and peace? Let's go back again. What is it going to take? And what is this disquieting exposure that can actually shake a man's worldview in our culture? I'm going to just look at a few things that I think we should think about as we think about disquieting exposure. One of those is believers willing to humbly discuss scientific evidence. There are a shortage today of apologists in our circles. There's a shortage of people who are willing to humbly talk about the thing of origins. We're viewed today by many as proud people that don't want to listen, don't want to consider facts, but just humbly listen, discuss it with people, ask good questions. Another, sacrificial love between believers. Love is powerful. We heard about this last night. We heard about the woman forgiving the man who had killed her husband. That's powerful. But so is love within the body of Christ. People laying down their lives for each other. That can be very disquieting. That's not what they're expecting to see from us. Giving up our own preferences for the good of others. That can be very disquieting to an unbeliever. Businessmen who ensure you win in a transaction. This is rare in America. I want you to think a little bit about your community. How do you think people in your neighborhood, the people around you, have drawn conclusions about you? Do you think that most of them have read your statement of faith, or they went over all your doctrines and thought about just who you are and analyzed it with other churches? I don't think so. Most of them have drawn conclusions from someplace else, and usually it's the marketplace. It's how you interact with them in business deals. And our churches should be famous for making sure that everyone wins in a transaction. We should be known for that. I want you to imagine churches like that. Imagine what it would be like if it was just known in a community. These people always make sure that you come out on top. They make sure you win. That would be disquieting exposure. I think that would shake an unbeliever. Believers who are vulnerable and honest with doubts, we are naturally drawn to authenticity. People are open with their doubts, very compelling to a seeker. I've seen it over and over again. You just start, go ahead and tell them some doubts you have. I've had people ask me about creation and things they don't understand. Tell them, I'm not sure about that either. Let's talk about it some more. It's okay to say this. I'm not sure about that. Can we get back and talk about it again? How about coffee next week? I want to look into that a little more, and let's talk about it some more. Remember, your goal is not to win the argument. Your goal is to win the soul. And authenticity, vulnerability is very powerful as you reach out to people. Functional families who reach out to the dysfunctional. The Anabaptist people today have an abundance of good functional families, but there's a shortage of families willing to reach out, willing to actually reach out even as families. You know, you are not going to reach out to the lost without being with them. You actually have a love for the lost. And instead of just quickly saying yes, answer this question. How much time in the last year have you spent with the lost? How much time have you actually spent with them, just sitting down and talking with them? I want you to notice the example of Matthew. It says, after these things, he, Jesus, went forth and saw a publican named Levi sitting at the receipt of custom, and he said unto him, follow me. And he, Matthew, left all, rose up and followed him. And Levi made him a great feast in his own house, and there was a great company of publicans and of others that sat down with them. Notice Levi's response to salvation. He invited his friends to his house, and Jesus was there too. Now, the Pharisees didn't think this was a good idea. You shouldn't be associating. But that's what Matthew did. How open is your home to unbelievers? How often do you have someone in your home? Levi used his home to reach out to others. One more. Literature which challenges the reader's position without questioning his dignity or intellect. Be careful what you hand out. It can be very demeaning to someone. Remember, these people already have a worldview, and they have facts to back this up. Little tracts sometimes can be very condescending to someone. You know, a person who's an atheist, they know there's complex questions out there. When you try to answer that in a simplistic way, just a quick answer, you are telling them you're not willing to wrestle deeply with this topic, and you've lost credibility. But our lives and church communities should be providing disquieting evidence. Now, there's a saying that all of us are familiar with that says you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Very common saying. You can't make someone believe something. I have had a friend in Washington who worked with horses, and he used to say this. He says, but you can give him salt, and salt creates thirst. And so there's some questions that follow this, and I want you to think about these questions. First of all, is your life making people thirsty? Is there enough salt in your life to provide disquieting evidence to someone's belief? I'm going to go further with this. Is your church community, is it making people thirsty? Are they seeing enough sacrificial love within your church community that it makes them say, wow, something's going on there. I need to take another look at this. Second area, are there cultural obstacles? Now, I want to say this. I talk to youth sometimes who say that I'm tired of culture. I'm going to do away with culture. You can't do away with culture. You're going to have one. The question may not be what you're leading. The question might be what you're going toward. What is the culture that you're moving toward? But the fact is, we do unknowingly sometimes place cultural obstacles in front of people. We had a situation in our congregation about 2-3 years ago. One of our ministers stood up and he addressed the group, but like this, something, he just used the phrase pilgrims and strangers. I forget how he said it. He might have said, welcome pilgrims and strangers. And there was a lady sitting there, it was her first time there, and her assumption was this, oh, so they're all pilgrims and he thinks I'm the stranger. And she didn't come back for quite a while. Now, he was just using King James lingo. He wasn't meaning anything by it. But sometimes we put obstacles in front of people without even thinking about it. But the question is this, are we insisting on things that are not necessary? Is this keeping people away So again, I went out and interviewed. I want to just give you a list of some things that I heard from people. You don't have to agree with them. I just want you to listen to them. First of all, many people assumed they would not be welcome. I want you to think about your posture to others. You know, it takes more than a sign out in front of your church to make people feel welcome in your church. Another one, aloof and condescending attitude. Cultural pride. I want to say this about this one. Every single person I interviewed quite a few, mentioned this one. It was usually number one. It was, in fact, last week I spent an hour and a half on the phone with a lady who just could not get done talking about this one. And she said this. She said, those of us who come to your churches, now she had started out in an evangelical church, and she made her way to another church, an Anabaptist church. She said, we come because we're on a spiritual journey. And we think we've arrived with a group that's also on a spiritual journey. But after a year or so, we find out they're not on a spiritual journey. They all think they've already arrived. And she said, that's very deflating to discover that, very discouraging. Sometimes we don't listen very well because we assume we have little to learn, very little curiosity about their life. Another one. Non-resistance, another hard sayings of Christ. And we're familiar with this, divorce and remarriage, a lot of these issues. These aren't things that we're willing to compromise on, but it can be very real in their lives. I've seen people wrestle with a thing of non-resistance. Maybe they had a lot of guns and ammunition and have to wrestle with this whole thing. They thought that was God's will to protect their family. It's reality in many people's lives. Gluttony, an undue focus on food. This one's an interesting one. I had one lady tell me this. She said, I can't figure out why you people keep sending the food around. We call it hospitality. They call it gluttony. She said, why are you so serious about some things, some scriptures, but this one here you kind of laugh about and you move on? What is it about food? Why are you so big on this thing of food? Some view it as a very poor use of resources. Another one, hypocrisy. Recreational activities, dress, etc. And this, sometimes I've said this many times, that we need people from non-Anabaptist background just as bad as they need us, because they are so good at pointing out hypocrisy. They're just so good at doing that. You know, we know that golf is out, downhill skiing. And we can talk about the waste of kingdom resources, waste of time and money, all this thing. And then the next thing they know, somebody's taking off on an expensive hunting trip. Or they just bought a four-wheeler and snowmobiles, and they're scratching their head. How does that work? Why was this wrong, but this over here is right? It's hypocrisy. Another one with regard to dress. Most of our churches, we don't allow a necktie. And we can explain that. You know, we tell them there's biblical principles here. It's ornamental, unnecessary, it's fashionable. Waste of money, long, nice list of things. And they come to church the next Sunday and they see a woman walking with a fancy, colorful scarf all wrapped around. And they can't figure that one out. Well, why was it wrong for the man to have a necktie, but it's okay to have this scarf wrapped around? These are things we place in front of people that many times drive them away. Another thing that people will say on this is, I can bring this up, but no one wants to listen to me on this topic. Apologetic about counterculture lifestyle. You know, when we tell people that our culture is just not very important to us, it's not a big deal to us. Would you want to join a group that was not excited about their culture, was always apologizing about it? Would you want that? There's a friend of mine who was an atheist at one point, and he made this comment. He said, I don't understand why our people keep trying to imitate our culture. It's what I come out of. Why do they keep going back that direction? Perceive they are a project. Scheduled hospitality. This is an interesting one. Most of us, many of us, have a host family. And so we're inviting seekers in, and we have somebody, a family or two, designated to take them home. And it's a good idea. We want to make sure everyone feels included. But I have repeatedly talked to people who discovered after about 2 years, all this time they thought, well, a couple of them have said, I thought you wanted to be with us. And I discovered we were just a project, actually. And I asked one of them, what would you prefer? She said, just tell us up front. Just tell us that we actually have a schedule. We're glad you're here, but we do have a schedule. People don't like to feel like a project. Another one, weird songs and phrases, a different language. A big one on this is memorized songs. Many times at a fellowship meal, somebody will just start a song and we'll all sing it together. I'll look over there and there's someone just standing there looking around. Understand what that feels like to someone. I'm all alone. I'm different. I'm not like you. Another one, frustration, seeing drift toward a culture they left. I mentioned this a little earlier. They're headed one way. They're trying to come away from the culture, and they're seeing people pushing at the fences, trying to go back the other direction. They're trying to figure this out. That can be very discouraging to someone. Another one, appearance, fear of evangelical friends. Fear of what their evangelical friends, maybe from the church they're leaving, are going to think about them. I have one tell me that they're going to assume when I start looking different that now I believe I'm saved by works. Now, I want to say this about appearance. When I talk to Anabaptist people, they think this is number one. When I talk to people who are from a non-Anabaptist background, it's never number one. It's usually way down at ways. Now, it is true. They wrestle with this. There's people that go back to their family reunions and wrestle with this. It's not like it's nothing, but it's not as big as we think it is. In fact, I had one man tell me this. He said, the youth in my congregation would like for dress to be the reason we don't have more converts, but it can be an issue for some. Another, hospitality, feelings of inadequacy. It's a big one. Not used to having company. I had one sister ask me this. Said, when we came, why didn't you teach us how to have company? Well, I didn't know you had to. I grew up with that. I didn't know that you had to teach anybody to have company. But it's a feeling that they have. Shallow conversation. This is the last one that I jotted down here. Reluctance to share. One individual said this, I've been a Mennonite for 15 years, and I have never had anyone share a deep struggle that they're having. And she said this, she said, I know there's struggles out there. The counseling centers are full. But all the conversations are shallow. No one wants to talk about deep issues. Now, there's many more examples, and I just want to say this. If you have people in your community from a non-Anabaptist background, take the time to sit down with them and listen. You'll learn a lot. You may have a lot of assumptions, but take the time to listen. I want to talk a little about authentic church communities. Our culture is more connected than ever digitally, and yet people feel more disconnected than ever. There's loneliness out there. It's increasing, in fact. There's an incredible amount of loneliness. People are longing to belong to something bigger than they are. That's good news for the church because we have something to offer them. It's a huge opportunity. Let's go back as we think about reaching out to our neighbor and look at some basic words of Jesus that we often forget. Jesus said this, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one to another. And again, in John, that they all may be one as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. Jesus wanted his followers to understand that the church, he wanted his church, his followers, to be so united, so knit together, people would look at that and say, wow, there's something there that I don't have. Now, typically today, when we think of missionaries, we think of strong people, maybe a William Carey or Amy Carmichael, people that did a tremendous amount of good, but I want us to go back and look at Jesus' original vision. Notice how the church started. And the multitude of them that believed were of one heart and of one soul. Neither said any of them that aught of the things which he possessed was his own, but they had all things common. And with great power gave the apostles witness of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. And great grace was upon them all. Neither was there any among them that lacked, for as many as were possessors of lands or houses sold them, and brought the prices of the things that were sold, and laid them down at the apostles' feet, and distribution was made unto every man according as he had need. What you're hearing there is a strong family unit. That's how the church was when it started. That's an authentic church community. It was a church community that felt and operated like a family. That's what it was. It was a church family. But you know, there's a big difference between a church family and a family church. Let's think a little about that. A church family is a gathering place for families on Sunday morning, for biological families. There's programs, there's activities, a nice place to worship. We tolerate each other's differences, and then we go back home. Church family, we come to worship, but also to blend lives together. And the goal is to demonstrate sacrificial love to seekers around us. Now, I put a couple slides together to illustrate this. I want you to picture each of these shapes as a biological family. Each one's different. There's rough edges. They're not all the same. They're all seeking Jesus. They're coming together. And they come together into a family church. It's a place where biological families meet. They connect with Jesus there. They tolerate their differences. Each family knows something, though. If the going gets tough, I can always go somewhere else. It's almost like keeping one foot outside. Notice that slashed line around there. If I find a better church, I can always leave it. It's a little like marrying, knowing that divorce is an option. If I find a better wife, I can go get another wife. Very little long-term commitment. But a church family is different. There's a strong effort to blend lives together. There's still diversity. There's still differences. But we're trying all the time to blend our lives together, to get closer together. We're humbly acknowledging that you're able to see something in my life that I don't see, and I want you to tell me about that. That can be painful at times. But that was Jesus' goal. Why was that Jesus' goal? Why did he want churches to operate like a family? It's very simple. Because seekers, potential new believers, are watching. Jesus said they're going to be drawn to groups that actually love each other like family. You know, seekers know that anyone can do this. This is how every secular organization out there operates. Just tolerate the differences. It's like joining a club. You join the club and you're part of it as long as it's a blessing to me, but I can always walk away and join another club if I want to. We had a Muslim girl in our community a while back. It's been a couple years now, several years. She spent a lot of time in our home. She went to the local college. She told me this. She was on a spiritual quest, and she spent a lot of time going to churches all over our community there. There were evangelical churches. And she said the people in those churches, there's very little relationship, actually. So I watched them. They come in, they sit on the same pew, and as soon as church is over, they're out and go back to their families. She said, in my Muslim culture, in the country where I come from, we have more community than that. But the seeker knows something, that a group that sacrificially loves each other, something is different. They're still different people. They're still different gifts. They have different preferences, but they've learned to submit to each other, a lot like the human body. A lot like our families. These people actually love each other. Now, I want to say this. In the Anabaptist world, in the conservative Anabaptist world, we have a problem. And I want to describe it just a little bit. I want to show a continuum that shows this family church to church family. Family church, it's a group of believers you worship with. The biological family unit is preeminent. And the goal of the church is to bless the family. The church family, it's a community of believers to which you are committed and accountable. The group is preeminent. And the goal of the family, the biological family, is to bless the church. Now hold that thought for just a minute. I want to overlay one more continuum on top of that. At the top, you're going to see churches that intentionally reach out locally. And at the bottom of this continuum, there's very little focus on outreach. Now, with that in mind, I want you to look at this. Now, I've numbered these just simply to talk about it here today, but I want you to picture, let's start with church number one. This is a church that likes to talk about outreach. They've got programs, they've got a mission board, they're all about reaching out, but there's not much commitment to each other. Members tend to bounce around. Visitors are going to come, but when they do, there's something missing. They just sense there's something missing. They're not always sure what it is. Now, diagonally, down to number four. Let's talk about that one just a little bit. Church number four is the opposite of church number one. Church number four has strong community. If someone's barn burns down, they're right there. They're going to take care of that. Very little thought of joining another church. They see themselves as totally committed for life. They're going to be there, but there's very little interest in reaching out to their neighbors. I want to submit that model two is what Jesus had in mind. A strong commitment to each other, and a strong desire to reach out to others. But I want to say this on the heels of that, model two is the most difficult of all these. It means laying down my own will and desire. It means giving up some things in my own life, my own preferences. It means dying to self. In an American culture, in our individualistic culture, that's extremely difficult. We don't do that very well. Now, as you look at this, I want you to be careful with this chart. It's easy to sit here and say, well, that's not my church. My church got some real problems. The point is this. What can you do in your community to make a difference? As you go back home again, how can you move your community closer to a model two? Remember, Jesus said this, that sacrificial love is how the world is actually going to know. They're going to see it there. I've made this statement before, and I've seen it in my own community at home. We have visitors come in sometimes, and I've seen times when there was just a little bit of tension. Maybe a couple families weren't getting along real well, just struggling to work something out. And I've said before, I think a visitor can tell in 5 minutes if that's going on in a community. There's like a sixth sense they have. They just sense that something isn't right here. Churches that effectively reach out. I want to look at some lessons from some churches that I feel like are attempting to reach out, and they are actually engaging seekers. Again, this is not one denomination or congregation. It's just some observations that I've made, and you may have some different ones. If we have time, I'd be glad to hear from some of you as well. First of all, churches that effectively reach out, they focus more on people than programs. You know, we like programs. They make us feel like we're achieving something. But what about just going out and building authentic relationships with people? What if everyone in this room in the next year simply built two or three close relationships in your community? How much impact would that have? We've got a lot of programs, a lot of activities, a lot of things going on, but how much more could be accomplished if we actually worked through relationships, not trying to take on the whole community in one whack, but simply reached out one at a time? What happens in your community when a tattooed struggler walks in? How does that person feel? Do they feel included? Do they feel welcome? Or are they even walking in? Where are we at with reaching out to the strugglers? What type of people actually followed Jesus? Churches that effectively reach out, they are willing to be vulnerable and authentic. I mentioned this before, it is so important. We like to get buses and lots of families and lots of people before we go do something. But I want to challenge you to be vulnerable. That means be willing to be outnumbered. That means being with people when there's more of them than there is with you. Go ahead and share your difficulties. You don't have to have all the answers. Just build a relationship with them. Show them that you are authentic, that you actually believe what you're saying. Sometimes we take a mass of people because we don't ever want to get in that kind of setting. Maybe it's because it's not authentic in our life. Are you willing to sit down with and be outnumbered by others? I want to say this. Our world today is craving authenticity. They are craving it. Churches that effectively reach out have borrow and lend relationships with neighbors. We have this assumption that when we move into a new area, that if I take Joe enough pastry, that he'll like me. But the fact is when I eat his tamales, our relationship grows closer, faster. It means that I accept him as a real person, that we're on the same level. We're both human. We're not any different. When I go into an area and I try to give and give and give and give and give, I'm building the perception that I think I'm somebody and you're down here. Borrow from your neighbors. I think it's good to find ways to interact. Go and ask them how they plant their plants and why their garden's better. I have a neighbor down the road that grows tomatoes like I've never seen anything like it. My wife makes fun of me because I always slow down and look at his tomatoes, and I never can get my tomatoes to grow like his. I go down and ask him, and he loves to talk about why his tomatoes are like that. That's how you build a relationship, not by giving and telling always, but sometimes asking and borrowing. Churches that effectively reach out bring the poor into their home. Isaiah 58 speaks of bringing the poor that are cast out into your home. When was the last time you had an unbelieving neighbor over for a meal? if you're going to be with them, if you're going to reach out to them, you need to be with them. Now, I'm not talking about continually hanging out with everybody in your neighborhood. And yet, if you're interested in reaching out, you have to have some relationship. We need to understand the danger that's there. Show them that you're human. Have conversations. Express your own concerns, your own problems, things you're not sure about, even your own doubts. Churches that effectively reach out sacrifice for authentic church community. They're building local church community. They're developing church family traditions. I want you to think about this a little bit. Right now, if I ask you to give up every tradition, all the things you do except for your church, all the family traditions, all your Christmas, all your Thanksgiving, everything about you that you enjoy except for the church, would there be enough there to satisfy you? Because understand, that's what you're asking others to do. Many of them are walking away from their family. They're giving up being with family. Do you have enough tradition within your church to actually satisfy them? What happens to the single mom down the road with three biracial children when Christmas comes around? And all of you run off to your biological families. Where is she at? Do you have enough room to bring her in too? I think it's important that churches build rich traditions, things they do together. It can be camping. It can be all kinds of things. That when someone comes in, they have a place they feel included as well. They're part of this. They're adopted into this church family. Churches that effectively reach out believe the battle is spiritual and prayer is essential. I want to repeat it again. You can't push enough buttons. You can't pull enough levers. You're going to have to be engaged in prayer. And I'm not just talking about prayer meetings. I'm talking about private prayer, alone with God. God is with us. And we're called today to be working with Him. We're going to need Him. I think about this many times. Jesus had the closest connection, I think we would all say, with His Father. And yet, how does your time in prayer alone spend with God's time, with Jesus' time when He was here with His Father? How much more do we need it today? Conclusion here, I want to look at the words of Timothy. Paul to Timothy, "Wherefore I put thee in remembrance, that thou stir up the gift of God which is in thee by the putting on of my hands. For God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind." Now, I want to say that I believe today with all my heart we have a tremendous heritage. You've been given so much. If you've been raised in an Anabaptist fellowship, you've been given so much. But we need to be stirred to action. We heard about that this morning. We don't need to be fearful. We need to have confidence that God is able. God has given us all things, and God intends that we pray for Him for guidance and then use our sound minds. Logic is needed. Recently, I talked to an individual who's getting ready to move off to a city, and he in the past has rebelled quite a bit against I would say, culture, Anabaptist culture. He told me this, and I'm getting ready to go, but I'm suddenly, as I look at moving into a big city away from everything that I've known, I'm suddenly realized that much of what I've been given is very, very important. And that's true. But the things you have been given are not just for you. They're also to share with others. I want to encourage you to go back to your community. Let's build strong communities that are able to bring people in, and we can have converts from our community. May the Lord bless you as you return back home.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.